So my topic is going to be the firstborn of Israel being redeemed by the tribe of Levi in the book of Numbers. The whole lecture series is about the book of Numbers. I have two goals for the lecture. The first goal being to talk about the redemption of the firstborn, but also to look at the idea of redemption and tie that into Jesus, because I think we see a lot of parallels and foreshadowing of what Jesus is going to do for us. Now, since I'm splitting a lecture effectively in half, it's going to probably have an unsatisfying ending this morning. I apologize for that, but since we want to try to keep the sermons not 2 hours long, we're going to cut it in the middle, just out of consideration of you guys. So, I apologize for that, but if you feel unsatisfied after ending the lecture in the middle, come tonight. So, that way you can hear the rest. So, I only made one or two modifications to the lecture. I cut out the most boring parts, so don't worry about that. I'm not saying none of it's going to be boring, but I hope that we can all be edified by this. It goes both ways. I get your feedback, and you get edification. So before we talk about redemption, the redemption of the firstborn, we need to talk about what the word redemption means. I didn't fully understand what the word redemption meant. I've always thought the word redemption kind of meant like a ransom, like you ransom, you get somebody out of slavery, which is a definition, but in the most simplest of terms, according to Merriam-Webster's, to redeem is to buy something back or to win something back. It can also refer to freeing something from distresses or harms, like freeing someone from captivity or ransoming them. Interestingly enough, in Merriam-Webster's definitions, one of the definitions they put for redeem is to free from the consequences of sin. I'm not going to read the whole. I have Merriam-Webster's excerpt here. The last thing I'll mention about Merriam-Webster's and the definition of the word redeem is it also talks about a releasing through a payment, a releasing from a lien by a payment or an amount of an amount secured by either removing the obligation of a debt or an equal exchange of something of value. All those ideas are going to be related to what we're talking about. God is going to redeem the firstborn of Israel with the tribe of Levi. He's going to free them from the debt that they owed him from the Passover by trading, by substituting the tribe of Levi in their place. And you can probably see where I'm going to get at, ultimately, with Christ. Christ is our substitute, taking our place on the cross, saving us from the debt of our sins, and bearing that on our behalf. So that's where I'll be headed at the very end of this lecture. So there's a couple examples of redemption in the law. It's actually much more than I originally thought. And it's something that's both in the narrative accounts of the law, the different stories, as well as in the law itself. And there's examples of redemption, and there's also, within those examples of redemption by substitution, where someone is redeemed by someone else taking their place. The first example I want to look at is in the law in Leviticus chapter 5, or chapter 25. Don't go to 5. You won't find anything there. Well, you'll find something, just not what we're looking for. In Leviticus chapter 25, this is an example in the law of Moses of a time where God would call the Israelites to take the place of another one in a time of need. In Leviticus 25, we're just going to read 25 and 26. It says, "If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer," that Hebrew word there means kinsman redeemer, the idea of a redeemer in your family or the duty of a kindred, "his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. If a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him calculate the years he sold it and pay back the balance to the man to whom he sold it, then return to his property." So in this example here, we talked in our Bible class this morning, actually, about how the Jewish people were taking advantage of the poor. This is not what they were doing. This is what they were supposed to be doing. If your brother became poor, the nearest family member was to come in, and after he sold his property, remember, their pieces of land were different from ours. Our land is often not just a place we live on, but it can also be just an investment asset. Well, they lived off of their land. It was their farmland. It'd be where they live. It was also their inheritance given by God. It was a lot more important as it is important to us. It was even more important to them. So important that God said, if you become destitute and you sell, your family has the obligation to come in and buy it back for you. I think something interesting here about this passage is the obligation goes to the other family member first. It's only if you don't have that other family member, then the obligation falls to you. And then it says later in the text, if you ultimately can't buy it back, it's returned to you during a year of Jubilee. But that just shows how important it was for them to own that property. That's besides the point for our lesson. All that being said, this is an example of a redeemer taking the place of the redeemed. When the redeemer bought the property back, in verse 27, after it's bought back, the man who originally owns it goes back to the property. It's not that the redeemer buys the land and then the land stays in the family in the hands of the redeemer. The redeemer takes the place of the redeemed by taking their debt upon themselves and buying back the land. Similar example to that in chapter 25 is 47 through 55. Once again, we won't read the whole text, but we see it. It's even more personal here. In verse 47, it says, if a stranger or sojourner with you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner with you or to a member of the stranger's clan, then after he is sold, he may be redeemed. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle or his cousin may redeem him, or a close relative from his clan may redeem him. Or if he grows rich, he may redeem himself. So in both passages, if the person after he sells himself or sells his property becomes rich, he can buy himself back. But if you're poor and you have to sell yourself as a slave, the chances of you becoming rich right away or at all is very slim. Otherwise, why would you have needed to sell yourself in the first place? So the family members are told, if that happens, after he's sold, you can buy him back. Once again, this is an example of a redeemer not just buying a property back and taking that debt upon himself, but taking the debt of the brother who is now a slave, he takes that debt upon himself and buys him back. Notice, if you read to the end of the passage, it says nothing about the family member now getting his poor brother as a slave. The only thing the redeeming family member gets is his poor brother's debt. He takes his debt upon himself so his brother may be free. He takes his place in that regard. There's also narrative accounts of redemption by someone taking another's place in the law. If you turn to Genesis 22, for two reasons I'm not going to read this story. We already read it recently, and in the lecture itself, I won't read all of it. In Genesis 22, God tells Abraham to offer his son Isaac. Now, God ultimately doesn't want Abraham to kill his son Isaac, but he's testing him to see if Abraham's willing to do whatever he needs to please God. And as Abraham is going up on the mountain to make a sacrifice, Isaac realizes, wait a second, we have fire, we have wood, but where's the sacrifice, Dad? And Abraham says, in verse 8, he says, Abraham says, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. So they went both together. That seems to satisfy Isaac. I think that kind of shows Abraham's faith, where Isaac knew Abraham had such a strong faith in God, and God has provided so much for Abraham. A statement like that was believable. If it was me at that age, I would have been really suspicious. But because of Abraham's reputation and his life of faith, I think Isaac accepts that answer. And the cool thing is that comes true. And that's a notable thing that Abraham remembers about this account. So as Abraham's about to offer his son in verse 13, Abraham lifted up his eyes and behold, and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So God tells Abraham to stop. He looks up. He sees the ram. And he didn't offer the ram as thanks for not having to kill his son. That'd be viable, I guess. But what he says is, what the text says, is he offers a ram in place of his son. God still required a sacrifice. God doesn't want his son. He did that as a test. But he still required a sacrifice. So the ram takes the death that theoretically would have been due Isaac. Abraham offered him instead. And we often read this story, and we kind of look at Abraham offering his son as an image of God in Christ. And I think that's valid. But I think actually the closest foreshadow of Christ is the ram. And Isaac is us. Just like the ram died in the place of Isaac, Christ died in our place. Another example is in Judah. Is Judah offering himself in the place of his son, of his brother Benjamin? Once again, we're not going to read that. But I think it's really interesting at the end of that account, because Judah offered himself to take the punishment that theoretically would have been due Benjamin, to the point of view from his father, he brought Benjamin back, he brought Simeon back, and he brought Joseph back from the dead. Through Judah, the ancestor of Jesus, him taking his brother's place, his father got his sons back from jail, from condemnation in the dead. I think another foreshadow of Jesus. Now, we're not here just to study stories of redemption. We're here also, specifically to study the redemption of the firstborn. So let's get into that. In Exodus 13, verse 1 and 2, this is after the Passover. Literally, chapter 12 is the story of the Passover. And in chapter 13, we're going to read a few excerpts where God informs Moses, you know how I spared all those firstborn during the Passover when you offered the lamb and you put the blood on the doorpost that angel of death passed over? Well, they're still mine. They owe their lives to me. So in Exodus 13, verses 1 and 2, the Lord said to Moses, consecrate to me all the firstborn. Whatever is to open the womb among the people of Israel, both a man and beast, is mine. When I started studying for this topic, you know, I didn't remember how much God talks about how much the firstborn belonged to him. Yes, he spared them during the Passover, but they still owe a debt to him. He spared their lives, so now they owe their lives to him. In chapter 13, verses 11 through 16, God continues on. He says, When the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and shall give it to you, you shall set apart to the Lord all the first that opens the womb. All the firstborn of your animals shall be the Lord's, that are male shall be the Lord's. Every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn man among your sons you shall redeem. And when in time to come your son asks you, what does this mean? You shall say to him, by strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. For when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animals. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that open the womb, but the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be a mark on your hand, or the frontlets between your eyes, for by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. Now, I can only imagine the tension that the parents would have heard, saying all the firstborns belong to God, and then he talks about how the donkeys, they're either replaced with a lamb or their necks are broken, and then now he starts saying the firstborn sons belong to me. And he doesn't say what that means. I can only imagine the tension of that. He'll explain later. Spoilers, he's going to redeem them with the tribe of Levi. But God lets them feel that tension. He doesn't say how they're to redeem them here. But he says what the purpose is. He says it's to be a reminder. You know, when we talk about the Passover, we compare it to the Lord's Supper, being a reminder of what God has done for us. It wasn't until I studied the subject that God had given them this as a reminder too. I think it's interesting. The firstborns owe a debt to God that he intends to actually provide a way for them to pay without having themselves to pay it. But also, in this debt, he's going to use it as a gift to give to them. In many ways, God taking the firstborns for himself and allowing them to redeem them back is going to be an opportunity for God to give to them multiple ways. This is the first way here. He's reminding them of his salvation. So in Numbers chapter 3, after like 15 minutes, we'll actually get in Numbers. In Numbers chapter 3, God claims the tribe of Levi, says he's going to give them to Aaron, and then he says why. I think that's a really interesting thing. So they have this tension. As from all my study, from Exodus 13 to Numbers 3, God does not explain how they're going to redeem their firstborn children. Maybe somebody can point me out if I'm missing something. But as far as I know, during all that time, there's no explanation how they're going to redeem them. And then, in God's timing, he tells them in chapter 3, verse 5, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the tribe of Levi near and set them before Aaron the priest, that they may minister to him, that they shall keep guard over him and over the whole congregation before the tent of meeting, as a minister at the tabernacle. They shall guard all the furnishings of the tent of meeting and keep guard over the people of Israel as a minister to the tabernacle. And you shall give Levites to Aaron and his sons. They are wholly given to him from among the people of Israel. And you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, and they shall guard the priesthood. And if any outsider comes near, he shall be put to death. It's interesting, God gives Levi their duties and their assignments and gives them to Aaron before he explains why. He's going to explain why in the next couple verses, so it's not that big of a deal. But I think this shows the preeminence of God in this redemption. When the Jews will ultimately offer Levi to God, it's going to be in the way God orchestrated, the way that he plans it, and it's going to be in his timing, and it was all his idea. It's not like Moses went to God and said, hey, Lord, you know you said the firstborns of our sons belong to you and we have to redeem them? How are we going to do that? Is this a valid option? No, you don't see any of that. It's God says it's going to happen, and then he starts telling them how it's going to happen. Even in their debt that they owe to God, God is the one taking initiative and preeminence and helping them pay it off. I think that's really interesting. So also, look what he's going to have the tribe of Levi do. He's not going to have them killed. He's not going to have their necks broken like an unredeemed donkey. But rather, he's going to give them so they can serve. They're going to serve Aaron in the priesthood. And part of their job is to protect the other tribes from getting too close and to protect the tabernacle from being looted and robbed. In them being given to God, God then takes them and gives them to his brethren, their brethren, to serve their brethren. It's kind of interesting. All the giving God is doing as he's paying, as their debt is being paid. So in verse 11, the Lord said to Moses, saying, behold, I've taken the Levites from among the people of Israel instead of every firstborn who opens a womb among the people of Israel. The Levites shall be mine, and all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I consecrated for my own all the firstborn of Israel, both of man and of beast. They shall be mine. I am the Lord. I think this shows us a lot of the character of God. God saying, Levi belongs to me. But what did he just do with them? He gave them to help everybody else. I think that shows the Lord's selflessness. But also, notice, In verse 12, he says, I have taken the Levites from among the people of Israel instead of every firstborn who opens a womb. If you look up the phrase instead of on the internet or in your dictionary, one of the synonyms is a substitute. He has taken the tribe of Levi as a substitute for the firstborn of Israel, which tells me that means if it wasn't the tribe of Levi working and guarding the tabernacle, it would have been the firstborn. And think about the logistical favor God is doing for the whole nation of Israel. Just imagine how complicated it would have been if every firstborn male from your family had to go live at a Levitical or firstborn city, I guess, serve in the tabernacle instead of being able to designate jobs by tribes. I can't imagine what that mess would have looked like. And then besides the logistical nightmare of sending your first sons away, what happened to your inheritance? What if you only had one child? What would have happened to your land inheritance? That would have been extremely complicated. In taking the tribe of Levi instead, he's doing every tribe a huge favor. Their sons wouldn't have died. They would have served God, which would have been a blessing. But as far as the everyday maintenance and maintaining of the family's land and their inheritance, man, that would have been so hard. So God, in having a substitute take their place, he offers a substitute that was better equipped to do the job. Instead of taking a firstborn from every family, he takes a whole tribe. That way there can be a whole tribal culture around serving in a tabernacle. They can have their own clans. They don't have to worry about like marrying other people. And no, it's within one tribe. He can designate duties by families. It's such a legit, it's logistically, it's a huge blessing. So when God takes a substitute, he often takes a substitute better equipped to do the job. So in the part we're going to skip for Gettysburg here is the numbering of the people. In verse 14, God says, list the sons of Levi by fathers' houses and by clans. Every male a month old and upward you shall list. We're skipping that. So in verse 38, after they number all the people, it says, those who were in the camp before the tabernacle in the east and before the tent of meeting towards the sunrise were Moses, Aaron, and his sons, guarding the sanctuary itself to protect the people of Israel. And any outsider who came near was to be put to death. All those listed among the Levites, who Moses and Aaron listed at the commandment of the Lord by clans, all the males from a month old and upward, were 22,000. So God is going to take the males of Levi as a substitute for the firstborn males within the camp of Israel. And they come to the number 22,000. And then they count the firstborn males in the camp. That's a lot shorter. In verse 40, the Lord said to Moses, list all the firstborn males of the people of Israel from a month old and upward, taking the number of their names, and you shall take the Levites for me. I am the Lord. Instead of the firstborn among the people of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites, instead of all the firstborn among the cattle of the people of Israel. So Moses listed all the firstborn among the people of Israel as the Lord commanded him, and all the firstborn males, according to the number of names, from a month old and upward listed, were 22,273. So I'm going to make a few comments about this section, and then we'll finish the section in this chapter, or finish the chapter. And it's really interesting that God is going to show his exactness and his thoroughness. He doesn't just say, I'll take Levi instead of the firstborn sons and leaves it at that. He wants there to be as accurate of a redemption as possible. We're going to see there's a number difference. In verse 39 and verse 43, there's 273 more firstborns than there are firstborn or male Levites. He's going to reconcile that. Something else we see is that not only is he going to take the tribe of Levi instead of the firstborn sons of Israel, he's going to take their cows in replacement of Israel's cows. That's kind of a funny thing to throw that in there. It kind of reminds me of the prophet Jonah, when Jonah's complaining that God didn't destroy Nineveh, and God said, how can I destroy all those people and animals? Shouldn't have I had compassion? Like, God is very thorough and very thoughtful in his considerations, and he includes redeeming the firstborn cattle. So I just think that's an interesting point of God's thoroughness. So in verse 44, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the people of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites instead of their cattle. The Levites shall be mine. I am the Lord. And as the redemption price for the 273 of the firstborn of the people of Israel, over and above the number of male Levites, you shall take 5 shekels per head. And you shall take them according to the shekel of the sanctuary, the shekel of 20 gerahs, and give the money to Aaron and his sons as a redemption price for those who are over. So Moses took the redemption money from those who were over and above those redeemed by the Levites. From the firstborn of the people of Israel, he took the money, 1,365 shekels, by the shekel of the sanctuary. And Moses gave the redemption money to Aaron and his sons according to the word of the Lord, as the Lord commanded Moses. You know, there's somebody who I have work for me sometimes, and whenever they work for me, they always want to round numbers up and down because it just makes things a lot simpler instead of paying them cents and pennies. God's not like that. He doesn't charge them any more or any less. And we might think, what's the difference of 200, about 300 people? We even round up when we're talking about things. What's the difference of about 300 people when you're talking to 22,000? But God is thorough. He made sure every single one of them were redeemed. He doesn't just say, oh, that's not a big deal. He's very thorough in how he does things. So he tells Moses, I'm going to take Levi, but for God to take them, they have to be given. And so we see God, them being given in Numbers chapter 8. So Numbers chapter 8, verse 5. After God claims them and tells them what their job is, he prepares Moses and Aaron, prepare them to be given. They're given as an offering, as a sacrifice. They're not killed, but they're prepared as if they were a sacrifice. In Numbers chapter 8, verse 5, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, take the Levites from among the people of Israel and cleanse them. Thus you shall do to cleanse them. Thus you shall do to them to cleanse them. Sprinkle the water of purification upon them. Let them go with a razor all over their body and wash their clothes and cleanse themselves. Let them take a bull from the herd and its grain offering, a fine flour mixed with oil. And you shall take another bull from the herd for a sin offering. And you shall bring the Levites before the tent of meeting and assemble the whole congregation of the people of Israel. When you bring the Levites before the Lord, and the people of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites, and Aaron shall offer the Levites before the Lord as a wave offering from the people of Israel, that they may do the service of the Lord. And the Levites shall lay their hands on the heads of the bulls, and you shall offer the one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering to the Lord to make atonement for the Levites. Then you shall set the Levites before Aaron and his sons and shall offer them as a wave offering to the Lord. So, this is a really interesting passage when you understand the significance of the laying on of hands. In the New Testament, the laying on of hands was how the apostles gave gifts of the Holy Spirit and how people in general would show approval. Here, it's different. In the Old Covenant, you see people laying their hands on a sacrifice before it's offered. In Leviticus chapter 4, when people would offer a sin offering, they would lay their hands on the sin offering who was to die in their place. In Leviticus 16, during the Day of Atonement, the high priest would take a goat, the scapegoat, and lay his hands on the goat and confess the sins of the people. And the text says in 19 through 22, he was putting the sins of the people on the scapegoat. And then he would send the scapegoat away with their sins. Now, I think it's important to understand what that means by that. In Leviticus 16, 9 through 20, or 19 through 22, when it says the high priest is putting the sins of the people on the goat, I don't think he's saying he's taking the bad attitudes and bad hearts of the people and magically implanting them on the goat. What I mean is, I don't think after that goat was set free, he went in through the wilderness smoking cigars, sleeping with hookers, and getting drunk. He didn't become evil. What happened was the sin debt of the people was put on the goats. Any bad attitudes or bad ideas was still in the people. But it's a symbol of the sin and their consequences being sent away. When we see the laying on of hands in the Old Covenant, it's a passing of responsibility. That's what we see here in Leviticus chapter 8. When God requested or commanded them, give them the firstborn here, they are to be purified. The Levites are to be purified, prepared as a pure, blameless, spotless offering. And then the people lay their hands on them. The passing on of their debt, the debt that they're going to fulfill on their behalf, the serving of God, is placed on the tribe of Levi. And God takes them instead. It's not that the Levites were now supposed to live the exact same lives of the firstborns who put their hands on them. It wasn't that they had all the responsibilities of their firstborns. The firstborn still needs to serve God. But that debt of they were owed, that they owed service to God because God redeemed them, was now on them. And that's what Christ did for us. Thank you very much for your participation and your listening. Some of you are falling asleep, so we're going to stop here. I thank you for pushing through. But what Christ did for us is Christ let us, our ancestors, both Jews and Gentile, lay their hands on him. In the New Testament, the Jews took him, his own disciples, his own disciple and the people from the high priest laid their hands on Jesus, handed him over to the Romans, who then they laid their hands on him. And I don't know how purpose that symbology is, but it's there. And Christ then took the responsibility and debt and paid the cost for our sins on that cross as a substitute. And the invitation is, that's not just given to anyone. It's made available to everyone. But if you want Christ to take your place, if you want to receive the benefit of him being your substitute, you need to be baptized into him. You need to die with him in the waters of baptism and be raised up in newness of life. You need to confess your sins. You need to confess him as Lord. You need to live faithful unto death. If there's any way we can help you, maybe you're not a Christian and you want to become a Christian. Maybe you are a Christian, you just need some help. We have this time set aside now that if there's any way we can help you, please come forward during the song of invitation.